you for joining us for another episode of A Journey Through Aussie Pop. I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au, and this is Robbie Molinari from Turn the Beat Around on Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Hi, Robbie.
Hey, Gavin. I hope you're buckled in securely because we are going back to a year we've been to a few times already. It's 1992.
That's right. We're going to party like it's 1992. And this time, it's a pop tale that intersects with a few of the stories we've told on this podcast so far. For one thing, it's an artist linked to that pop breeding ground soap opera E Street.
But there are some big differences in how this singer's music career played out. And it's a really interesting story with all the standard twists and turns and headaches that we like on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Gavin, tell everybody who we're talking about.
Okay, it's singer, actress, presenter, jungle survivor Toni Perrin, who made the leap into music with her debut single In Your Room.
As we mentioned, Toni came to fame as one of the stars of Channel 10's soap opera E Street, a role she landed when she was a teenager still in high school. Having grown up going to talent school, embarking on a career in the entertainment industry was hardly a surprise. But what was unexpected, for Toni at least, was that it was through acting and not singing.
Yeah, music had always been Toni's number one passion. She told me that she idolised Kate Sobrano and Kylie Minogue. But let's hear from Toni herself about taking on the role of Toni Windsor on E Street and how, despite that show being responsible for some chart hits, she didn't jump at the first musical opportunity that came her way. How did the E Street role come about? Was it just another audition?
Yeah, it was just another audition. I was in year 12 and the audition came up. I think I had to audition probably four times until I got the part. And then when I did get the part, my parents told me I couldn't take it and I fought them and I won. But they told me I had to stay in school and finish year 12. Yeah, we all got our wish.
In the back of your mind, were you thinking this could be a pathway to a music career?
Always. You know, music and singing was always the passion. I mean, I enjoyed acting, but I never really imagined myself getting a job at 17, that's for sure. When Melissa Couts, she signed to West Side Records, to Forrest Redlich's label, which was, you know, the creator of E Street. I remember when she signed with their label, I was just devastated. And I was offered a contract with Westside. But thankfully, my manager, who I'd been with for a very, very long time, she advised me against it. I seriously would have done anything. You know, you could have given me a jar of Vegemite and I would have sung anything. You know, like, I was so desperate to launch a music career.
I understand there was an idea for the song you might do for Westside.
Oh, yeah. He wanted me, because my character was with Harley, the son of Reverend Bob. He wanted me to record Son of a Preacher Man. You know, he was the son of a preacher man. I mean, it's a great song. It's a great song. But at the time, my manager had a lot of foresight and she said, I think this would not be great for you, because she knew how much I wanted to pursue it.
I mean, it was a bit gimmicky, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been very gimmicky for the show. But a lot of great music was launched from West Side Records at that period of time.
Although Westside Records wasn't the right fit for Toni, another musical opportunity came her way when she was asked to sing the Melbourne Moore disco classic This Is It on the Channel 10 network promo.
How good was that ad?
So good.
Yeah, the networks used to always try to outdo each other with their promos. Look at all the shows and stars we have. But that This Is It performance has never been bettered. And it's on YouTube. I could watch it all day.
I thought it was brilliant. I know that I even went as far as recording it on VHS back in the day. And I used to watch it over and over, but all I ever wanted was a full version of that song.
Yeah, that didn't happen. And let's hear from Toni. Why not?
Oh, Oh, yeah. How awesome was that? I mean, seriously, firstly, the song is fantastic. It's such a killer song. And then Kelly Abbey, she choreographed it. And when I was growing up, Kelly Abbey was like a goddess to me. Yeah, but I remember when they approached me, oh, look, it was seriously like all the planets had aligned for that very moment. And they dressed me up like Madonna with the high pony and the corset. And also, like, when we were growing up, I always dreamed of being in the entertainment industry, being on television, being a part of that world. And when I was growing up, you know how the network promos were always such a big thing, you know, the big launch at the beginning of the year. And I remember, you know, sitting in front of the television thinking, oh, one day I want that to be me. And there I was living out my dream. And I remember everyone was saying to me, you should release that as a single.
Did that conversation ever get to a serious point?
No, I think that was before, yeah, that was before I was with Mushroom. It was never a serious discussion. You know, I was so young and, but, oh yeah, I should have. Danny Minogue did a great job.
So while all of this was going on, E Street and getting offered a deal with Westside and doing this Channel 10 ad, Tony was actually in a group. It was a vocal group called Connection with friends of hers from the talent school she'd attended while she was growing up. So given everything that was going on in Tony's life and in her performing life, it was only a matter of time until a record label came calling.
That label was Michael Gadinsky's Mushroom Records, with Gary Ashley, who'd steered Kylie Minogue's early career, taking a keen interest in Tony. As we heard in the Radio Freedom episode, Westside Records had run into problems before long, so an established, solid label like Mushroom was perfect.
Perfect. Let's hear from Tony about getting that record deal and how the song that Gary Ashley suggested she record wasn't quite what she was expecting. Okay, so you did sign with Mushroom, and by that point we'd seen Kylie, we'd seen Jason, we'd seen Craig come from Neighbours, and we'd seen Melissa come from your own show. Was that a good thing in the sense that you didn't have to break down that barrier of going from TV to music, or was it kind of like, oh, here we go again, here's another one?
There was definitely a lot of cynicism, but, you know, I was really living my dreams, so I was just kind of focused on that. There was definitely, it was a hard egg to crack, that one, because people already had such a preconceived notion of why I was doing it. I was just lucky, you know. I just happened to get a job on a national TV show, yet I'd always dreamed of being a musician. And I don't know whether if I had of, you know, who knows what path I would have gone down, but I know that music would have always dragged me. So, yeah, it was definitely difficult, but it was so exciting watching Melissa Couts do it. You know, I remember being at her shows, like on Oxford Street, watching her thinking, one day it's going to be me. You know, I was so excited for her, but I really had a vision for what I wanted to do. So I really just pushed aside the naysayers and went for it.
Now, you were signed by Gary Ashley. What vision did he have for you?
Gary really saw me as the next Kylie or the next Danny. He really kind of had a clear pop vision for what it had to be. Like for the first song, In Your Room, I remember when he originally played me the song and it was country and western. It was actually quite, I want to walk into your room, like with the guitar. And, you know, he had the vision. He had the vision that he thought that would make a great pop song. And he was right. And I think, you know, there was always, I always had this kind of feeling towards something that wasn't, you know, straight down the line pop. I wanted something that was just a bit more soulful. Gary and I often came to, you know, a bit of loggerheads about that because I wanted a career.
So In Your Room being the country song, did you hear that and just go, what?
Well, I mean, I really trusted Gary and the team that I had around me. And you could definitely hear it was a good song, you know, and I've never been shy of a country song. I mean, I actually grew up with country music. My manager's husband is a country singer. And so we used to travel around the country with him performing in all these different venues and I would do the backing vocals. So I was singing Neil Diamond way before I launched a pop career. It's amazing how these people with vision just know what's going to work. It's exciting to be working with people that just have a gut instinct for this stuff.
And so you went into the studio to record that. What was it like recording in your room? Had you been in a recording studio before?
Yeah, because I kind of grew up in an environment where, I mean, the talent school where I grew up had a recording studio in it. And, you know, we were recording stuff all the time. So, I mean, I'd never kind of been in an environment where there was so much at stake. I had a major label behind me and a major label wanting the goods. And I remember being quite intimidated by the people around me because I had come from a television show. So there was that kind of, I felt like I had to prove myself. You know, and I remember everyone going, oh, it's been auto-tuned and oh, that, carrying on. It wasn't, and we worked hard, and but people like to criticize.
The pop version of In Your Room was released in November 1992 and reached number 10 on the ARIA singles chart. I instantly loved this track. I thought it was a sweet little pop soul number, and in my opinion, it still sounds good today. But lyrically, it's got those few little amusing lines in it, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I want to be your oxygen.
You breathe me out, you breathe me in.
And what does she want to do when she goes into his room?
My favourite, I want to walk into your room and try on all your clothes. I mean, where is she going with this?
I really liked In Your Room as well. It reminded me a little bit of maybe something Margaret Ehrlich might do, but younger.
Okay.
So not out and out dance pop like Euphoria or Melissa. A little bit more of a sophisticated, as you said, soulful pop, but still had a younger edge.
I think that's actually a really good point. Quite often you get these young girls singing these really mature love songs that are just going into so much detail, but she wasn't going there. She was just keeping it real. You know, the song lyrically fitted perfectly.
Yeah, she got a crush on this guy.
Yeah.
Kind of, I guess, reminiscent of I Should Be So Lucky in some ways. That's a song where Kylie's got a crush on the guy and, oh, I should be so lucky to go out with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of similar sentiment in a way. I really like the middle eight of the song as well. Let's have a listen to that.
I love it. But you know what, Gavin? You can keep your middle eight and I'm going to have the B-side to In Your Room. There was a song on the CD single that was called Love Vibration that didn't appear on the LP and it is such a great little pop song. Let's take a quick listen to Love Vibration right now. One thing I never knew was that there were two videos filmed for In Your Room, one we saw and one that we didn't. Times have changed now that we have social media and YouTube and you can jump online, you can find it, all these things, but I'd love to see that first video. Tony's going to tell us all about it, but it sounds hilarious.
We'd actually shot a whole different clip and I was playing a like the French maid and I turned up at the hotel room in the little French maid's outfit. And I was in my dream boy's room and going through all these things and rolling around on his bed. And Gary Ashley decided that was a little bit too obscure, not mainstream, straight down the line enough. He thought that the storyline just didn't put me in the right pocket. So we did a reshoot. And that's when you saw like the blue dress. I was stapled to like the dress was actually stapled to the floor. And, you know, and when we had my two backing dancers in the little hot pants, that's when that was all created.
Was it Adam Garcia who was in that with you?
Yeah. He played my love interest. Like you see him in the like the dance break, I guess you say. He's doing all that kind of very kind of balletic stuff. He was amazing, seriously. Like, you know, when you just meet someone and you go, they're a star. He's one of those people. And he was such a standout and such a nice guy in the video that we demanded that be left in the music video. So that's why he remains in the music video. Because it was so beautiful. I don't know where that video went. I have no idea. There's so much in the vault. And if I had have been smart enough, I would have kept it all.
Tony's second single, I Want You, was released in April 1993 and repeated the success of In Your Room. It also peaked at number 10 on the ARIA singles chart and went gold. For me, again, this is another solid pop soul track. And it's a good one for getting your feelings out there without being too overt, you know? It's wholesome and it still stands the test of time.
Lots of yearning.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's have a bit of a listen to it. That was I Want You, and there's a sweetness and simplicity to this song that I like, and that Funfair video really matched the mood of the song perfectly. Mm. Tony looks really pretty, and it's just, yeah, really nice and sweet in a good way. I could actually see I Want You starting out as a country song rather than In Your Room, but it was actually co-written by Australian singer-songwriter Jenny Forbes, who was also signed to Mushroom as an artist.
Yeah, I remember the reference to Jenny Forbes writing this track, because then Mushroom Records ended up releasing a couple of her own songs later on down the track, which didn't take off, unfortunately, but they were good solid pop songs as well. And I bought, you know, a couple of her tracks. But anyhow, moving along, there's also an interesting story about how the song found its way from Jenny to Tony. Let's hear it from Tony herself.
It's such a great song, and I always love singing it. And I think I Want You, because it was the second release, it wasn't the obvious pop choice, but I think it made people see that I was serious about music, that I loved music, and that's kind of where I wanted to go. It's still a great song. I still am very proud of that song.
You were sitting down with the writer, Jenny Forbes, going through her songs, weren't you?
Yeah, I was going through her songs. She was playing me a whole heap of stuff, and I Want You was the one that I wanted. I was like, I want you. And I remember she wouldn't let me have it. She goes, you can have any song. They're all for you except that one. And I said, well, why? Why would you play it for me if you're not going to let me have it? And she goes, because I want to record that one. And so then I went to Gary and I said, okay, she played me all of her songs, but I Want You is the one that I want to release. And then the battle started. I have to be proud of my tenacity. But yeah, but I remember that moment of her saying, you can have them all, but not that one. And I remember looking into her eyes thinking, no, I'm having that song. You can't play it for me and then take it back. I was really determined.
So the first two singles both went top 10. How did that feel? Back-to-back top 10 hits.
Oh, there's no better feeling. I mean, especially since I dreamed of it since I was a child. And yeah, like nothing beats that feeling. I liken it to a football player who wins the grand final, you know, like they'll never replace that feeling. It's the same for me, that feeling of hearing your song on the radio for the first time, watching the ARIA charts, just all of that anticipation, receiving your gold record from your record company, you know, all those things that you only ever dream about, and then they actually happen. And I keep saying to myself now, did I peak too soon? A lot of things I dreamed of as a child came true at such a young age.
Now, Robbie, two top 10 hits, but there was a bit of a problem. Tony had no album ready.
Tony began the task of going through songs for what would eventually become Tony Parent's intimate album, to give its full title, or Intimate for short. As well as the first two singles and the two more that would come, which we'll get to, there was a mix of pop songs sent to Mushroom from various publishers around the world. What Tony didn't realise at the time was that a few of those songs had already been recorded by other artists.
Indeed, Celine Dion had included Halfway to Heaven on her 1992 self-titled album. Let's hear both versions of that song.
Raining in My Heart was also recorded by the song's original songwriters, Tracy Yarrod and Sam McNally, and released under the band name Say Yes in 1991. Now, the original version of this song was almost impossible to find. It's not on YouTube or available to stream anywhere, but I did manage to track down a copy on Discogs thanks to Velcro Frog. So let's have a quick listen to the original Raining in My Heart along with Tony's version.
Still in love.
then, of course, British pop singer Sonia had recorded Walk Away Lover on her 1991 self-titled album. Let's take a listen to Sonia and Tony's versions now.
Okay, so we've got all that out of the way. Let's hear from Tony about putting together Intimate. What kind of deal were you on at that point? Were they just saying, oh, we'll put a couple of singles out and we see how they go? Or had they signed you for an album deal? Or
no, they signed me for an album. It was just that I didn't have an album ready to go. And so just finding the right songs. And because I didn't want to be a puppet, I wanted to actually have a say, a part of it. I wanted to be a part of the creation. It just wasn't as straightforward as they were probably hoping. I mean, in hindsight, it would have been nice for me to be a bit more prepared. It's a long process, you know, and if I ever did it again, I'd have all my ducks in a row. I'd have all my songs and away I go. But in saying that, I'll probably do the exact opposite. And you'll say to me, Gavin, you told me that you were going to have your album ready to go, Tony, and you don't.
Did you feel pressure after those two songs had done well? Right, now I've got to find material that kind of matches that level.
Yeah. Of course, you know, there's a lot of pressure from the record company saying you need hits. There's that. Then there was also the pressure of the amount of money that is spent, the videos, the marketing, the album, the single covers, all of it. It all has to add up. I think also I got it in my head that I just wanted to be taken seriously. I didn't think I was, and no one was listening to me and all those kinds of things.
So then it was time to get this album happening and you went over to London, right?
Yeah. I went over and I recorded the whole album. So I'd chosen all the songs, written this, you know, some of the songs, and then we went to Bristol and recorded with a team called DNA.
DNA had done Tom's Diner. They remixed Shocked for Kylie. They had form in making pop hits. What was it like working with them?
You know what? I could have stayed in that environment forever. I could be the age I am now, still sitting in their recording studio. That is my happy place. To be working in that way, to be creating something, being in Bristol and recording with these people that I so admired. Yeah, we had a really good time and I'm so thankful that they made a great record with me.
One other song included on the album was actually an intentional cover version, wasn't it, Robbie?
Yeah, it certainly was. Tony recorded a version of Scottish soul group Average White Band's If I Ever Lose This Heaven, and it was the last song to be added to Intimate that she had recorded when she was back in Sydney. Let's hear the original version of the song and then Tony's cover.
Okay, so with the album complete, a year and a half after I Want You had been released, Walk Away Lover became Tony's third single in October 1994.
As well as recording the album during that time, Tony had appeared in Home and Away for a couple of months in early 1994, playing a high school teacher at Summer Bay High, but I can't help but think the delay was a problem.
Yeah, look, Tony is the first to admit that in hindsight she would have done things differently, but she got the album she was happy with, and really, Walk Away Lover should have been massive. It's a great song.
It's an amazing song, and it's just get your heart racing because it's just that high tempo pop number.
You jump up on the podiums, don't you, Robbie?
Look, you'd have to hold me down. He was like, Robbie, get down, get down.
Walk away from the podiums, Robbie.
No, I love Walk Away Lover.
It's really good, but unfortunately, it didn't perform as well as her first two singles, did it?
Absolute criminal. This should have been a bigger hit, and I think it's being discovered more and more as the decades go on. You know, a lot of people have admitted their love for this track, and it means that it potentially could have been that bigger hit back in the day.
That's right. It got to number 35, but honestly, why didn't more people go out and buy this track? Let's hear from Tony about Walk Away Lover. Pulling the songs together, what stood out about Walk Away Lover?
Oh, I think it was just the 60s vibe of it, the lyrics, like everything. It's just a great, fun song. And I remember at the time my manager was always saying to me, this is your hit, Tony. This is an amazing song. We just felt the energy of it from the minute we heard it.
Was it a relief to have music out again because it had been a while?
Oh, look, I did so much in between I Want You and Walk Away Lover. But, yeah, I mean, I was just excited to put something else out. Yeah, and knowing that it was such a great song, but also, you know, I mean, there's all that stuff of will people like it, will people buy it, all that kind of stuff. The fact that virtually every second week I get a text message from a friend saying, oh, my God, I'm at the Palms and they're playing Walk Away Lover. The Palms on Oxford Street. It's pretty amazing.
Last time we spoke, we did talk about the bear costume.
Oh, look, you know, I was young and very influenced by, you know, outsiders, and I decided that I wanted to do something a bit quirky. The director, Paul Goldman, said that I should represent my quirky side. You know, let's do something a bit kind of out there. He did Better the Devil You Know for Kylie Minogue. So, you know, when people come into your life, you have to trust them, especially of that caliber. Well, he did I Want You for me too, actually, which is a great music video. But yeah, so look, we were just having some fun. It was a stupid idea. I wish I still had the bear suit because that would have been great for dress-ups with my kids. I loved all the stuff where I'm kind of dancing around with the red dress on, that really short red dress. Whew. And I remember a guy, a really close friend of mine at the time, Ken Thompson, he styled it and he got that red dress made and he got these shoes made that were just amazing. They were like, they weren't crystal, but they looked like crystal. The whole thing was kind of plastic, but perspex. Oh my God, they were so spectacular. You know how you go, God, I wish I had kept those. Where did they go? There was like a lot of thought that went into that look. And I really loved that part of Walk Away Lover. I think that actually represents the song, you know, just that kind of disco fun element. And the whole choreography was really 60s. Yeah, it was fun. I had a lot of fun creating different ideas for that song.
One final single was released from Intimate. Joy came out in March 1995 and unfortunately missed the top 50. Let's take a listen. It's a celebration, joy. Can you feel it, love? We all need it, peace.
Last forever, joy. Keeps us together. What I like about Joy is the fact that Tony worked with Ashley Cadell on this track.
Now, Ashley was in an Australian indie dance band called Flotsam Jetsam in the 80s, and he would go on to write for Kate Sobrano, Peter Andre, Zan, and then, of course, Tony. I think Joy's a cute song, you know. I always get into it when I listen to it, and it's hard not to.
Yeah, for me, this was another great song that should have been bigger. It's upbeat, it's optimistic. It was perfect for 1995 when dance music was really dominant in Australia. Although I will say that I prefer the album version to the mix that came out as the main single version. If it was going to be remixed, maybe it should have had a complete Eurodance overhaul. Get Motivate involved.
It had been too long in between tracks, so I guess they needed to update it as such. But yeah, Eurodance was booming at this point. Now, everybody knows, especially if you've been listening to our podcast, that it doesn't just come down to how good your songs are. Things were changing at Mushroom that impacted the attention that Tony should have been given. Let's go back to Tony, and she'll tell us all about that working relationship with Mushroom.
By the time we got to Walk Away Lover, which is such a great song, the record company was saying we don't have the same amount of money for the music video and all that kind of stuff. And you can start to feel the bubble bursting. You can start to feel the push and you're going, oh, okay, all righty. And then by the time it got to Joy, oh, there were just too many people in my head, too much going on. I just was going, I've just actually lost sight of everything, you know, and still such a great song. And I remember writing it and feeling so much passion for it. But you know what? I wouldn't change any of it, really. Yeah, it was interesting.
Gary had also left to go open Mushroom in the UK, hadn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And he was my biggest ally for sure. I mean, Michael Gudinski was always a great guy. I adore Michael Gudinski. But I don't think he had the same enthusiasm as Gary had for me. Yeah, and that's when, unfortunately, that's when, you know, I lost my biggest ally. And it just kind of wasn't the same. And I think maybe Mushroom was going through changes financially for their stable. And, you know, and I think Michael, although he had Kylie and he, you know, is always such a big believer in Kylie, he would always say to me, oh, in the beginning, I didn't see it with Kylie Minogue, you know, like when she signed doing Locomotion, he's like, oh, Perrin, I never saw it. Like, so I don't know whether that kind of pop was his thing. I think he always loved the rock, that kind of pub band and from the earth up, you know, he's not from the disco ball. Yeah, we were really pushing it uphill for sure. Yeah, there just wasn't the same kind of, because there'd been such a long gap between the success of In Your Room and I Want You to now. We were really just like, we were winding the wheels, trying to get the momentum. And, you know, and I still had so much visibility and I was doing so many different things. But once you lose that person that's in your corner, it's hard to find that new person because they're trying to find their act that they can discover. Like for Gary, he discovered Kylie and then he thought, Tony's going to be my new Kylie. But in saying that, you know, I remember when I was at that time and I remember everyone saying to me, oh my God, you're going to be the new Kylie Minogue. And I remember just feeling this. I adore Kylie. I love Kylie so much. Yet I remember thinking, but I don't want to be Kylie. It's hard. It's hard finding your place in that pool of music.
You wanted to be you.
Yeah, but unfortunately, yeah, at Mushroom, I mean, you know, record companies have always been cesspool of insecurities. And so, yeah, unfortunately, yeah, I lost Gary and then I just had people just pushing me down.
So Tony moved on from the Intimate album and began work on what would have been her second album. And Robbie, much like David Dixon's unreleased solo album, this is another of those missing moments from Australian pop music history, isn't it?
Unfortunately, it is. Those tracks that Tony worked on at this point have never seen the light of day. And I've got a funny story to tell about this. I actually had a moment with Tony Perrin back in 1996, and I just want to fill everybody in on this. So I was at the Michael Jackson concert, the History World Tour at the MCG in Melbourne. It was packed. Everybody was there. And I just remember seeing so many celebrity faces. You know, Human Nature had supported. I remember seeing Toby in the crowd walking through. I remember seeing Hugh Jackman. But then I saw Tony Perrin. And I would have been, what, maybe 20? Bit overexcited to be at Jackson's concert. And I yelled out to her. I said, hey, Tony Perrin. And she was absolutely lovely. She turned around as soon as I yelled her name out and she smiled and she said hello. And I said, when is the second album coming out? And she said to me, when's your birthday? And I said, it's September 18. And she goes, it's coming out then.
Oh, smooth.
Smooth Tony. But let me tell you something for nothing. I've had a few birthdays since then and I still haven't seen this album. Plus, you mentioned David Dixon because, of course, this is where Tony's story intersects with another of the artists we've covered on this podcast, and that's Indecent Obsession.
Let's let Tony explain what did end up happening with that second album, why it intersects with the Indecent Obsession story, and what happened with her Mushroom deal in the end.
Let's. I want to hear this.
Here is Tony.
So I started, seriously, I just turned 50. I can't remember any names. Michael Samowski from Indecent Obsession. Yeah, so we started working together. Awesome. He was amazing. We lived around the corner from each other. It was seriously like a dream come true. I would walk to the studio. Yeah, so we started writing stuff together. And I think I was at a time in my life, like I would have been, I mean, I was early 20s. There was a lot going on, a lot. Firstly, with the record label. Secondly, in my personal life. Thirdly, you know, I'd grown up in the public eye, all this kind of stuff. Yeah, there was a lot going on in my personal life. So, yeah, I was putting it into my music.
And how far did that process get with Michael? I mean, how many tracks are we talking?
I reckon we recorded probably 7. 8. Like, we recorded a lot. We worked together for a long time. And he put a lot of time and energy into what we were doing. He was just fantastic and gave me a lot of confidence as a songwriter. But unfortunately, the new person at the label heard it and didn't like it. It wasn't pop enough. It was showing an obviously more sensitive, vulnerable side to me, which is something I wanted to explore. And we all know that when Kylie shows her vulnerable side, nobody really gets it, do they? So it was kind of the same for me. I think when you're that age and you're wanting to try new things in music, you know, you don't want to be doing the same. Yeah, and so a lot of the songs were really kind of telling the story of where I was at, and yeah, and the label heard it and went, nah, don't like it. It's not pop. We don't think it works. And yeah, and then I lost my deal. And I remember that feeling of losing my deal was kind of the first time I'd ever lost something that really meant something to me, which was devastating because it was everything to me, this deal, my music career, all of it. Yeah, it was absolutely devastating.
From what you told me last time, I don't think it was helped by one person in particular, the confrontation you talked about where one person kind of broke you down a little bit.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He, I can't remember his name and I choose not to. He'd worked for INXS. He obviously knows something. But yeah, I remember he called me to tell me that they were ending my deal. And I was at my girlfriend's clothing store in Double Bay. And he called me and just told me on the spot, like, no discussions, nothing like, thank you for the success you've had with Mushroom Records and what you've done. Just, we're ending your deal. And then being a person who asks questions, I said, why? And then he proceeded on the phone in the middle of Double Bay to tell me that he didn't think I could sing and all my vocals were doubled and that is why. And yeah, I've never been more, yeah, just shocked and just like disappointed in my life. Anyway, you know, sometimes his voice still comes into my head and I have to tell him to go away. Like, even at my old age, I still hear his voice in my head. And I just, it's amazing how people feel that that's okay. Like, and I was saying to him at the time, but everyone doubles their vocals. Everyone will double their vocals on a chorus. Listen to the radio. That's what you hear. It makes the vocals pop. We're talking about pop music. And yeah, anyway, that's what happened, friends.
I mean, it's a bit like breaking up with someone by text message.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was so heartless. You know, I was 24 or something like that, 24, 25 years old. But that's the industry for you.
Generally, though, how did you find being a 20-something female in the Australian music industry with its pub rock background and its blokiness? Was it hard to navigate?
Yeah, it was always really disappointing. I'm having success as a pop artist. And I just remember, you know, I don't know if it was more so me just feeling intimidated by the environment that I wasn't considered a serious musician. Yeah, of course it was tough. Yeah, it was tough. I think people believed that it was fluff and they could take advantage of so many of the artists. And, you know, we just wanted to break into the industry somehow.
Robbie, that's pretty harsh, right?
It's absolutely awful, but none of it is a surprise. But Tony wasn't going to be put off, you know, and in true professionalism style, she dusted herself off and headed to America to try her luck there.
She sure did. She was signed to a publishing deal by Chrysalis Music, and all that was needed was a label for her to put out more music.
This is the part of Tony's musical journey I know nothing about. So let's hear her tell us what happened over in America.
So after I lost the deal with Mushroom, and then I was thinking, what's next for me? What do I want to do? And I knew that I had to explore music further. I wasn't done. I had to see what I could actually do. And so I went to New York and I was just kind of trying to figure it all out. I'd done a song with Andrew Klippel from Euphoria. I think I'd written the chorus on his piano and I started to do some co-writes with American producers. I was writing with Tina Arena, the people who wrote Chains for Tina Arena. I was working with them, that's right. And I went into the studio and I played them this chorus that I'd written. And then we wrote a song around this chorus. And then Mark Friedman from Chrysalis heard the song and he said, I want to sign her. And so he championed me. And then I started like a four-year, I was signed to them for 4 years where they were developing me as an artist. And they always really believed in me. They were fantastic. I always had this feeling that I had to make it work. So, you know, I'm writing with this person, I'm writing with that person. We think you should do country. BMG, Nashville were looking for the next Shania Twain. And my one of the people from Chrysalis had said to me, what do you think? And I went, yes, I love country. So then, you know, I'm like standing at Capitol Records, Studio B, which was a dream come true. I was like, oh, my God, I'm in the legendary studio singing for the head of BMG Nashville. And then, you know, they turned around and said, yeah, it's not quite authentic enough. Fair enough. Yeah, so look, they were throwing all kinds of things at me. And in the end, we started to do dance again, but just nothing was gelling. It was hard. It was really hard. But the one thing that it taught me was the hustle. Like, I'm a hustler now. I can hustle my way in and out of anything after being in LA for 5 years. And just my determination, like, I'll give anything a try. I'll say yes to anything. Yeah, but they were really nurturing. But unfortunately, I never got that deal. They couldn't release it. They were a publishing company, so they only handled songwriters. So it was about me getting the deal. Yeah, anyway, the rest is history.
Do you look back on the Intimate album and the associated singles? Do you look back on that period fondly, despite the ups and downs?
The fact that people still contact me now with social media and say, I still listen to that album. It's still one of my favorites. I mean, I think at the time I was really proud of what I'd created, but I was so kind of in the moment that I didn't realize it was making the impact that it was. And when you're having that kind of success, you are always looking, well, what's the next move? You know, what are we going to do next? You never actually sit there and enjoy that moment. And so, yeah, I mean, the fact that people still love it. And I, you know, and I'm really proud of the fact that I really kind of created something that obviously resonated with people still. That's really special. You know, there was something, it was a special time. The 90s was such a special time where we got to celebrate. We got to just be free and love pop music and, you know, and not be ashamed. You know, we were out and proud pop lovers. Yeah, I'm really happy that I was a part of that era.
And it sounds like you had such a strong hand in creating that album, you know, choosing the songs, co-writing songs. You know, you said you didn't want to be a puppet. You weren't a puppet. You made that album.
Yeah, I mean, it was always something I struggled with, and it's always something artists struggle with. You know, I know even the best of the best, you know, I've spoken to them and they have moments in their career where they're like, I'll do anything. I just want to chart hit. It's the same all over. But I'm glad that because I wanted to put so much of myself into the album, it obviously connected with people. And I think as a performer, I know ever since I was a little girl, all I ever wanted to do was connect with people, whether it be through music, through acting, through TV presenting. All of them to me are ways to connect with people and make people feel like we're all the same, we're not alone. You know, I hear you, you hear me. And that's all I've ever wanted to do. And I think that's why my career has been so varied, because to me, it's all just a way of me connecting.
So while Toni might not have reignited her pop career, she's been busy over the years acting, presenting Australia's Funniest Home Video, appearing on reality shows like Dancing with the Stars and I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And she also took a big chunk out of the public eye to raise her two kids.
And Intimate is an album that pop fans still love. I know I certainly do. This is something that probably hasn't really ever left the top of my, you know, stereo. I always bring this one out and play it regularly. Oh no, this album for me is actually a really strong soul pop album. I listen to this and it's quite soulful. I love this. And I think Toni should be insanely proud of this album. You know, I know she probably went through some interesting times getting it out there and putting it together. And then just seeing Toni pop up over the years, you know, on various different shows and things, she hasn't changed a bit. That bright and bubbly personality is always there.
Yeah, and I think there was a huge sigh of relief when it came out on streaming and digital platforms. It wasn't there for a long time. And then it did get released and people have been able to revisit it. Unlike some of the albums that we've talked about or some of the singles we've talked about on this podcast, Toni is on streaming, thank goodness. And yeah, it's great to revisit those tracks. And as she said, she gets contacted by people all the time wanting to talk about it. So that is fantastic. And yeah, bright and bubbly as ever. You know, she was just killing herself laughing through our interview, even though some of the things you went through obviously weren't that pleasant. But, you know, she's got a good attitude about it all.
Yeah, yeah. What a good sport. And I think, unfortunately, we've heard the story so many times and it happens to a lot of these pop artists when they're at such a young age. So hopefully that means that they're just at that right age to be able to bounce back and take on those different things in life afterwards.
That is true. And, you know, when we started this podcast, it was to, you know, shine a light on these stories that aren't being told, that no one's talking about, because as we always say, rock gets all the attention. And it's so interesting that back then it was rock got all the attention, rock got all the love. You could have three flop albums and the record company would still be behind you because, yeah, you were a rock band. And these pop artists, the minute they stopped having a top 10 single, it was like, yeah, okay, we wash our hands of you.
We're not even going to promote your
album.
Yeah,
not very nice. But, you know, pop does live on and that's what we're here to represent. Now, Robbie, we have another exciting pop story to tell next, and we will announce who that is with on social media before the next episode drops in a couple of weeks. Robbie, where can people find you?
Okay, I'm at Joy Toon Beat Around on all the standard socials, Insta, Facey, Twitter. And of course, I'm live every Friday night on Melbourne's Joy 94.9 with Turn the Beat Around.
And you can find me at ChartBeatsAU on Twitter and Instagram, and look for ChartBeats, A Journey Through Pop on Facebook. And if you want to listen to the bonus material for this episode, we're going to put the full interview with Toni Perrin up. That's at chartbeats.com.au/Aussie, and you can subscribe to listen to all the bonus material. As always, thank you for joining us. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Gavin. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.